is At Your Service, the podcast where pelvic health physiotherapists Emma Brockwell and Gwanya Donnelly talk to incredible guests who help lift the lid and bust the myths on all things pelvic health.
Hey Gwanya, I've got a rather alarming stat for you, if you don't mind me running it past you.
Yes, what is it?
Did you know that one out of three women will experience some form of bladder weakness in their lifetime, even though bladder issues are largely treatable and preventable?
Really? That many?
And the thing is, bladder weakness is something women rarely talk about. The majority just accept it as a facet of childbirth and ageing.
It's good we're talking about it then, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a start, but still many women feel isolated and don't approach their GP for help. The good news is that Jude, the sponsors of this podcast, are working to change all that.
Ah, in what way?
Well, for a start, they have a fabulous community of women on Facebook called Jude and Friends, which offers support to women living with bladder weakness. Thousands of women in the Jude community do pelvic floor exercises and challenges together and share tips on how to improve their bladder health. They also have a Jude urogynecologist who offers expert advice and support.
That sounds good. What else did you do?
They have a clinically proven supplement program, which has been shown to reduce leaks by 79% and nighttime wheeze by 39%. And they make pads and liners, which are fully compostable and made from bamboo. They've also recently launched leak-proof pants.
Sounds cool. Where can I find out more?
Just go to www.wearejude.com and search for Jude and Friends in Facebook to join the community. And here's the good bit. All At Your Service listeners will get 20% off all Jude products if they use the code CERVIX20.
Ah, thanks, Emma. I might just go and do that. At least we've got the conversation started, right?
Hello, welcome back to At Your Service. I'm Emma Brockwell and I'm flying solo today because Gwanya is actually in clinic and is far too busy, unfortunately, to be able to join me. But that gives me extra special time with our next very special guest. So let me introduce you. I'm going to be speaking to Jo Prance, who is a personal trainer, yoga instructor, ostomate and a mum. In 1998, Jo was 22 when she sustained life-changing injuries during the traumatic birth of her son. The extent of these devastating injuries only manifested over time, and she could never have imagined the ordeal of what the subsequent 23 years would bring or the impact her childbirth experience would have on the rest of her life. As a result, she has undergone multiple treatments, procedures, and over 17 surgical interventions, including TVT mesh, sacral neuromodulation, and colostomy surgery. Her personal experience of the consequences of severe childbirth injuries has given Jo considerable expertise and insight into women's health issues, particularly related to pelvic floor dysfunction. Through her work as speaker and educator, she's keen to raise awareness of how life-changing severe childbirth injuries are to those who suffer them and their families, and to improve the outcomes for those affected by these injuries. Jo began her involvement with the MASIC Foundation in 2019, and this is a charity that supports women who have suffered serious injuries like obstetric anal sphincter injuries during childbirth and is a MASIC advocate. She's also been engaged with Project Work for Colostomy UK, a charity that supports and empowers people living with a stoma. So you can hear how very special this lady is. So we're lucky to have you here, Jo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Emma. It's a privilege to be here and share my experience with you.
Oh, thank you very much. I want to get straight in there, Jo, really. I've touched a little bit there on your journey, but can you tell us about the birth of your son 24 years ago?
I know. So 24 years ago, if you looked at my birth on paper, it would look like nothing out of the ordinary had really happened. I went in for an induction. I was 22 years old. I was also a single mother and totally unprepared for what was about to unravel, basically. I had a friend from university who came into the hospital with me. So they started an induction about 7 a.m. in the morning and not a lot happened. Towards the back end of the afternoon, it was decided that they should push things along a bit. So I was given more of the drug that they induce you with and I started to contract quite heavily at this point. So the birth accelerated extremely quickly. I was then given more of the drug, and that was just too much. So despite my protests that I was really fearful that things were heading much quicker than they should have been and trying to get help, they came and had a look and went away again. And about 5 minutes later, I really pleaded with my friend to go back and get help again, by which point things had reached a critical point. So I was wheeled frantically down the corridors, completely exposed. I'd soiled the bed, got berated for soiling the bed.
Oh, no.
Got to the labour room and they were telling me not to push. But the overwhelming urge and the contractions were so severe, I had no option. He just forced his way out. So there were no interventions in terms of forceps or episiotomies. He literally tore his way out. So that was part of the reason I sustained my injuries. Secondly, I wasn't ever evaluated in terms of risk factors. Now, I was carrying a large baby, and that became evident when they weighed him afterwards. The other thing was when they actually looked at the tears that I sustained, both perineally and vaginally, they graded them as second-degree tears. So throughout this process, I'd never seen a doctor or an obstetrician. I had two midwives looking after me. And when it came to repairing these injuries, I had a big argument going over me. So one was saying, you need a surgical repair. And the other one was saying, no, I'm going to handle it. So unfortunately, she did. And though she superficially stitched me up, she stitched me up in more ways than one, as it turned out, because her repair and her diagnosis wasn't good enough. So further down the line, problems started to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout that whole process, it was totally barbaric. I had no pain relief whatsoever. Mm. I actually thought I was going to die. And my one thought was, I can't die. I have a son to look after.
Yeah.
Who's going to look after my child? It was excruciating being repaired afterwards. So the day after his birth, I had an immensely swollen perineum. And somebody was going to come and look at it. And I think they came and looked and went away. Something else was supposed to happen, and it never did. I was given some sort of cooling packs. And then it was said on my notes that I discharged myself. I didn't. I was actually told I could go home.
Oh.
So I went home, stitched, bruised, battered with a baby, thinking that all this was relatively normal. You know, I thought hospitals were safe spaces. It never occurred to me that anything untoward had happened. The community nurse would come round, examine my son, look at his progress, have a quick peek underneath and sort of recoil in horror. And this went on for weeks. I could perch on one side. I couldn't sit down properly. And as far as I was concerned, this was normal vaginal delivery.
Oh, my gosh. And the whole time, were you on your own throughout this predominantly, Jo?
I met my husband when my son was coming up to his fourth birthday.
Right. Okay. So you were very much on your own birthing, and then in those early postnatal years, where you need that support, especially when you've experienced that level of birth trauma. How did you cope mentally?
Well, the thing was, I didn't know there was anything really that wrong.
Right.
You know, I just thought this was all normal. I didn't have any symptoms at the time in terms of incontinence. They came later.
Yeah.
So,
and that's the big thing, because that's what I wanted to touch on. You know, were you symptomatic straight after having baby, or did that take a little bit of time? Can you tell us sort of from a symptomatic point of view where that journey began?
So really, it was 12 months after the birth. So he's about coming up to 1 year old, and I had a really bad cough. And every time I coughed, I started leaking urine. And the cough went away, but when that cleared up, the incontinence didn't. And then it went beyond just coughing. It was then things like stepping onto a bus. It could be any sort of jolting movement, and I was just kept leaking. So I went to my doctor. I mean, this is the one thing that I have always been very proactive on my journey, is I've always tried to get help. You know, I haven't left things. And my doctor said, thought, okay, yes, we'll refer you back to the hospital for some physiotherapy. So I had extensive physiotherapy, including biofeedback.
Okay.
Probably about 4 months worth of it. But it really wasn't making that much of a difference. So in the end, I was referred to back to gynecology and worked up towards being fitted with a TVT mesh.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right.
But one of the things.
Thickens.
Yes. So at that time, urodynamic studies were a little bit more rudimentary, shall we say, than some of the more sophisticated tests I've had in recent years. So I remember entering this room of men with clipboards, a square piece of paper on the floor.
Sounds so archaic, doesn't it?
And being told to perform star jumps over this piece of paper so they could see how much urine I was leaking.
Yeah, anything but glamorous, right?
Yeah. So anyway, again, who was I to question any of this? It proved a point. And I was worked up and decided that I was the perfect candidate for a TBT mesh. So for our listeners who are not aware what that is, that's a sling. It's essentially made of like polypropylene and it fits around the neck of the bladder to give it support. And that will therefore prevent the stress urinary incontinence. You're awake.
Which at that time, it was incredibly, it was a really common procedure, wasn't it? That was the kind of go-to around stress urinary incontinence.
Well, I was actually the first
youngest
patient. I was only 24 to have had that fitted. It was a new thing.
Oh, so you were right on the edge or the cusp of that being introduced into the medical world.
So this is 2000 we're talking about now.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So in 2000, I was the youngest patient. And I was told it was like minimally invasive. I tried to think of questions to ask. And it was things like, you know, what happens in the future? And they said, well, you know, if it starts to fail in the future, it's a bit like Velcro. We'll just put another one in over the top of the other one.
Oh, goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Obviously, the conversation around me having further children came up. And at that point, you know, I'm incontinent with urinary incontinence. I'm not thinking of having any more children.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, that is not on the radar at the moment. I'm on my own. And they said, well, if you did have another child, we'd have to consider, you know, maybe taking it out. And then you'd have to have another one put back in. But obviously that wasn't where I was at.
Yeah, you're just desperate to resolve the symptoms and get some of your norm back.
Yeah, so the day of the procedure, obviously you're awake for it. They have to have you awake because you need to cough to mimic the symptoms that you've got so they can see how tightly they're fitting this tape in.
Oh,
not long into the surgery, unfortunately, my bladder was perforated. So I had a catheter after the surgery. And I was quite a squeamish person back then. You know, the idea of blood, anything coming out of the body used to really freak me out. But there I was sort of traipsing around with this catheter and bag of urine. And obviously I had to get my mum to come over and look after my son because I'm on my own.
And your son was how old at this time?
So my son's two.
Two. Oh my God. Goodness.
And my mum didn't live anywhere near me. You know, she lived further afield. So it involved getting a plane to come and see me. So she was trying to juggle work, coming over to look after me. And she stayed with me for about 2 weeks.
Wow. So you were recovering again back on your own quite quickly.
Yeah. Gosh. Anyway, after the TBT was put in, it became abundantly clear 2 weeks later, I had severe pain on the left side and I developed a hematoma and I'd also got an infection. Now, I mentioned the pain because the pain was really, really awful. It was quite a gnawing pain, very distinctive. And I was told it would disappear in time. So the infection went, but unfortunately, that was always there. I could never get free of it. So now I'm dry, but I've got pelvic pain. It was 3 months after that was fitted that I then started developing fecal incontinence and episodes of urgency and then loss of control with my bowel.
So in effect, having the TVT, would you argue, made your symptoms a whole lot worse?
I've never really had definitive answers why my bowel incontinence started where it did. Was it the birth? Was it the mesh? I think further investigation a bit later on would show that I did have scarring on the anal sphincter, which is definitely connected to the childbirth. Whether the TVT mesh anatomically structurally changed the support and therefore there, you know, one person's hypothesis was that possibly the bladder had started to relax more on towards the bowel wall with the support that was causing issue. I don't know. I don't think I'll ever get the answers to all of this.
No, I agree. And unfortunately, you're not alone in this, are you? You know, there's lots of women who have been through what you've been, similar stories, who won't ever get the answers and who have similar-ish stories around certainly mesh and obviously missed obstetric anal sphincter injury as well. We'll come back to that in just a moment. I want to, if it's okay, go on to discuss the faecal incontinence that you were experiencing, because in truth, I don't think we talk about it anywhere near enough. And, you know, we really appreciate you talking about it today, because I think by talking about it, it's going to really help other women listening who may be experiencing fecal incontinence. And it's a taboo beyond the taboo of stress urinary incontinence, really, isn't it? So you started to develop fecal incontinence after having the surgery. Can you talk us through that and the impact it had on your life?
Yeah, so it started out of the blue. I suddenly found myself getting very little warning and literally running to the loo. This went on for a few weeks. And then I had been out with my son in the car, just got home, hadn't actually made it into the house. I was still in the car gathering my belongings. And I had this horrific, overwhelming urge to go to the loo. And everything came out. And I was just mortified, horrified. I just didn't know what to deal with first. At the time, I lived in a block of flats. My flat was right on the top floor. I'm in a mess. The car's in a mess. I've got a son to try and get upstairs as well. And I just broke down and wept. I just thought, what on earth is happening to my body? Cleared it all up, went to the doctor. And bearing in mind, I've already had surgery for stress urinary incontinence.
Yeah, of course.
Nobody at this point has ever said to me, you've got stress urinary incontinence because you've had childbirth. You know, it was almost implied that I must have had a weak bladder beforehand, that I had symptoms before I had my son. And this carried on into when I then got bowel problems.
You know, the dots were never getting joined.
No, and they were never getting explained to me either. But I was beginning to get very suspicious at this point. I mean, yeah. I've never had problems with incontinence, and then to have had quite a severe bladder surgery and now find out I can't control my bowel. It just was beyond my comprehension as to how I was in such a mess. You know, I was a very active woman. So the doctor sort of put me on loperamide, what I call horrible stop and go medicine. And really my body just didn't like that at all. It just confused things. So I would get bunged up, then I'd have more incontinence. It was intimated that because I was on my own, I was under stress, it must be IBS. I'd also done quite a lot of foreign travel at that point. I did actually have to go abroad several times a year for the job I was in, Thailand and other places. And it was maybe thought that I picked up some sort of virus or a bug there, had all those tests. I mean, this had been going on for about 9 months by the time I actually had my fecal matter tested for this. I was muddling along. I remember being at a show in Vegas and literally sitting down to watch a Cirque du Soleil show and with business colleagues, yeah. And suddenly getting the urge. And those corridors in hotels and places in Vegas are long. And I didn't make it.
Oh, how awful. How awful.
I just had to try and clear myself up as best I can and go back into where I was. Nobody knew.
Oh my God.
Nobody knew at all. It was just horrific.
The impact, not just the physical impact, but the what it must have done to you mentally, that must have been devastating.
It was. I just couldn't ever predict what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, clearly the problem didn't go away. So I got referred back to physiotherapy again. But this time it was focusing on rectal physiotherapy. Okay. So rectal biofeedback, which is actually really unpleasant.
Yeah.
For any of your people listening, it's where you're having your pelvic floor muscles, but the ones that affect the rectal area to contract. So mm-hmm. you've got a current in effect trying to stimulate those muscles. And I found that afterwards I'd be trying to travel home and I'd be getting incontinence afterwards.
Oh, God.
It was also really painful. And in the end, I gave up with it. I just couldn't cope with it. It was just such a painful treatment for me to undergo. And it actually wasn't making things any better.
All right, I was going to say, did it actually help? Because I suppose if you're undergoing that level of discomfort, but it's helping, at least there's that impetus to still go. But no, it wasn't making any difference.
it wasn't making any difference. The whole connection to me seemed to be almost neural, so that there was that block between when you wanted to go and being able to control, and no warning, and I couldn't feel like I could empty properly. There was always something there. So I was given glycerin suppositories. I found that they just sort of wanted to come out, you know, they didn't stay in. And so I then eventually got to see a colorectal consultant. So my son's probably coming up to about 5 at this point. And he said, well, yes, I had anal manometry studies. And he said, well, there is some scarring on the anal sphincter. One of the key factors in all of this, the fact I had second degree perineal tear on my nose did me no favours whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Because the symptoms I were experiencing seemed far worse than for somebody who'd experienced a second degree perineal tear.
And so they were looking at the second degree perineal tear, glossing over the fact that you'd had a second degree perineal tear, not even considering that maybe they just got that wrong. Did that discussion ever happen? Did they maybe say, oh, actually, I just wonder if you did experience a third degree tear?
No. And one of the things that I still get very mad about now, because I try and not to get wound up or angry about my situation, because actually the only person it affects is me. it's about, I would say, probably 3 years on after the birth, when these problems of bowel incontinence particularly were rearing their head. I went back to the hospital where my son was born to ask why I had these issues. You know, I wanted to look at my notes. I wanted to see what had happened.
Yeah.
I wanted to try and rationalize why I was in such a mess.
Of course.
And I had a really unfortunate response from the consultant who had taken over from the one who'd put the mesh in. And he was quite new, very gung-ho. And he said to me, oh, you know, you've had a traumatic birth. You're psychologically scarred. You just need a box of chocolates, some tissues, don't cry, and all of this is going to go away. Now, he did two things to me. He left me really demoralized. He hadn't listened to me. And the third thing he did was he actually took away my probably one opportunity where, if I was ever going to be able to have any sort of litigation case on this, that was the crux point, the three-year point. The point of knowledge when you know that there is something wrong or something potentially gone wrong. Even at that point, I would never have known where I was going to be 17 years later. You know, I couldn't have even seen then how much more stuff I would have had to go through. But that's the one thing I resent him for, is the fact he fobbed me off. And I feel I was fobbed off partly, probably, because they knew.
Part,
I may have had a case. The further I got away from the birth, so when we get to 5 years, 7 years, when I go and see other clinicians, I'm met with, you should have had a cesarean. Why didn't you have a cesarean? You had a large baby. And that doesn't help me either, because I can't change what's happened.
No, of course.
But of course, at that point, it's safe to point the finger and say, actually, what happened at the birth, the combination of events, is why you're in the mess you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that women who experience first and second degree tears, and I'm saying this just to highlight this to anyone listening, not to try and make any excuse or anything for what's happened to you, Jo, but we know that women who have first or second degree tears shouldn't be experiencing fecal incontinence. We know as physios that if anyone comes into our clinic with any signs of fecal incontinence or wind incontinence, that there's a possibility that perhaps a third degree injury or third or fourth degree injury took place, and therefore we should be referring you back in to see the consultant for further investigation. But that just didn't happen to you at all, did it? And I appreciate your fecal incontinence happened a little later, but the reality is you didn't have that support or anyone clinically reasoning that throughout your journey, really, did you?
Yeah, and I think the other key thing, even from that early outset, although gynecology had referred me to colorectal in that instance, there was never any tied up or joined up thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you've got Hadrian's wall separating your vagina and your rectum. and nobody is talking about what's going on in the wall.
Yeah, absolutely. And you still see it, you know, there's that real divide of that team and that team, people working in their silos, and we aren't joining the dots up for women. And it's not okay. It's definitely not okay in the instance of birth injury, for certain. I'd like to think we've got a bit better with that. I think we've still got some way to go in improving that.
Hi guys, it's just me. Sorry to interrupt the conversation, but I just need to tell you that we have two sponsors for this particular episode. So we are not only sponsored by Jude for this episode, but we're also sponsored again by our long-standing sponsor, Pelvic Relief. So let me just tell you, or at least remind you about them. Born out of necessity, Pelvic Relief was founded by mother of three, Eleanor Gardner, for all those who discovered they couldn't access quality products and information to manage conditions such as pelvic pain, incontinence and painful sex. Led by science and quality, Pelvic Relief have brought together best-in-class products for pelvic health, including SoulSource Silicon and GRS Dilators, O-Nut, Desert Harvest, EVB Support Wear, Period and Incontinence Pants, EZ Magic and Yes Lubricants and Moisturisers. So go check them out. But for now, before you do that, carry on listening to this fab conversation.
If I go back to your symptoms of fecal incontinence, so obviously you saw the consultant. What was the next stage in your treatment? Physio wasn't for you. So what was the next stage in how we helped you manage? Was your management helped?
So I then ended up having a surgical repair. So I had a surgical transanal rectocele repair done by the colorectal surgeon.
And was that effective?
Only for about 18 months.
Oh, gosh. And were you, in those 18 months, were you completely symptom-free of
your incontinence? I was for 18 months. I think maybe partly why it didn't last was I think I was left with quite bad prolapses after my son was born, and I was never really, they weren't really ever addressed. I think further down the line, when these same prolapses still existed, there's great reluctance to repair rectocele because of changing the anorectal angle.
Yeah.
So if you straighten up the angle, therefore the evacuation system could be a lot quicker.
Yeah.
So it's almost like this pocket of reservoir that you've got could be potentially slowing things down and doing you a favor. But when you can't evacuate that reservoir, it's hugely uncomfortable. And the reservoir got bigger and bigger over time in my case. So while they temporarily fixed it from the anal side, I then had a vaginal rectoentrocele as well. So by this point I have moved. So I lived up in the Midlands when my son was born, and I moved down south. I met my husband, we moved in together. And, you know, my husband's been very, very supportive. Of course, we had no idea that when I met him, which was on the cusp of all this bowel stuff starting.
Right, okay.
I met him shortly before that surgery. So it was, you know, we thought, great, sorted out now. Mm. When I moved down south, the problems reared their head again. And that was when I ended up going back to see my local hospital, and colorectal surgeon there was quite a sensible man in the fact that he said, you've already had quite a lot of surgery.
Yeah.
I think we've got to think really carefully what we do with you. And I think this is really important because sometimes doing something isn't always the right thing to do if it could potentially make things worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I've already had something that's fairly new and in the TVT, and that's, I still have this ongoing left-sided pain that is still simmering in the background. Mm-hmm. Still not getting any answers on it. However, I've had lots of investigation. Why have I got pelvic pain? You know, have I got endometriosis? Have I got other things? Ending up with more laparoscopic surgeries to find out, and an ablation, because they think that, okay, we'll give you an ablation, maybe the pain will go. It didn't. It starts becoming like a horrible tangled ball of wool now that you're trying to unpick. Anyway, the surgeon referred me and said, I think there's this new thing called sacral, it was called neurostimulation. It's called sacral neuromodulation now.
Yes.
I think you could be a candidate for this. You know, we don't quite understand how it works. However, their indications are good that it could control, fecal incontinence in your situation. Can sometimes help with bladder incontinence.
And what does that involve, Jo, for those who don't know?
Well, it involves you have a trial. So you have some leads that go into the sacrum. And when I say leads, these leads come out of the spine externally to start with. And you wear a battery pack, which is tied around your waist. It looks similar to an 80s Walkman.
Yes, I remember them well.
Yeah. And you wear this for 2 weeks. The idea is that you've got sacral nerves, S1 to S4. S1 to S3 are supposed to be slightly better ones to use.
Yeah.
In terms of delivering some sort of awareness to the bowel movement, the bowel mechanism, so that you can have that awareness that when you want to go. For me, that's how it worked. It gave me a little bit more awareness that, oh, I can feel something's happening now. Maybe I should go to the toilet.
Right.
Rather than having that, I need to go now.
Yes.
So on the trial, it seemed to work okay. The trial is hard to replicate the exact thing because obviously you've got this external battery pack. It's quite rudimentary in some ways.
Yeah.
Anyway, the trial was successful, and then you have a permanent implant put in. Now, the permanent implant is a bit like a cardiac pacemaker. Mm-hmm. I also happen to work in cardiac rehab too, so I was very familiar with cardiac pacemakers. So the cardiac pacemaker, the battery component of it, or the neuromodulator component, is implanted in your buttock.
Yeah.
Then all the wires from that go under the skin into the foramen of the sacrum. So depending on which sacral nerve they're trying to access, the wires go into there. They've got a little screw and they screw in. So I was deemed suitable candidate for that. And again, I was probably about the fourth person at the hospital to have had one of these put in. This is 2006 now. So right on the cusp of them being used, they were being trialed in effect. And I remember coming round, I had a general anesthetic coming round, feeling like I'd had the biggest abdominal workout in the world.
Oh gosh.
And the Medtronic rep was there, you know, and they've got this giant programmer and I've got a mini programmer, and they're programming it and setting the settings for it. So these settings control the stimulation that you're going to get that will ultimately give you that sort of hopefully control from the device. Yeah. So the first device did actually seem to make a bit of a difference for about 18 months. However,
okay, right. So 18 months, like the same with the surgery?
Same as the surgery. And then at 18 months, almost overnight, my symptoms came back.
Oh, shame.
And I was thinking, so I, you know, phoned up and said, oh, you know, I think there's something gone, you know, not right with it. And then I started to get some shocks from it. So it's like shock-like symptoms.
Into your sort of hip and back or?
Yeah, but they could be quite intense. It could almost feel like it was going into the rectum at times too.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So I knew there was something not right with the device.
Yeah.
Anyway, did a bit of investigation. See, when you've got these things in, you're reliant on x-rays and stuff like that. These leads are quite fine. It's hard to see any fractures or, you know, breakdowns in it. And ultimately, the leads had failed.
Oh, my goodness.
So to cut a long story short, because this goes on for years now, I did have about 6 different attempts at either changing leads, aspects of the neuromodulator to try and get it to work again, but I never had the same efficacy again. Mm-hmm. From an activity perspective, if you look at the brochures at the time, you know, show people running, playing tennis, all this other stuff on the brochures, you know, you can be really active with these devices in your spine. My concern was with my cardiac rehab hat on. I know that when people had pacemakers put in, you'd say, right, restrict your shoulder movements for 4 to 6 weeks, let the wires bed in. I really did look after these devices.
Yeah.
You know, I made sure I didn't do excessive spinal flexion and extension. In some ways, I was almost guiding them to the things that I was saying, you know, have you thought about this? You know, somebody bending over to empty the dishwasher, emptying the washing machine, when you're giving people guidance on what's suitable after this surgery, you know, because there was very little guidance.
Just as there is with most sort of gynae surgery, there's very little guidance for women out there as to how to rehab. In fact, there isn't really anything. And often, I don't know if you were told something similar, but often they take the really conservative approach of don't lift again. You know, I had a lady last week in clinic who'd had a total hysterectomy, and she's been told never to lift any more than a kettle again, which is utter madness and totally impractical. But, you know, we're 2022 now. This wasn't as far back as when you had your surgery. And yet I don't really feel it's moved on hugely, to be honest. We just don't have the consideration of rehab and women's need for functionality, obviously. So you, I can well imagine, were guiding these medical experts in how to rehab yourself post-operatively.
It's just one thing they hadn't thought of. You know, people think about going to the gym or exercising, but actually, what about the physicality of stuff you do around your house? You know,
exactly.
Hoovering, cleaning windows, all this other stuff. Things that are very, very physical. Any of those reaching movements, you know.
Things you need to do.
Yeah.
Things we need to make sure you can do.
And if you have a small child involved as well, and you're having to bend down and pick them
exactly.
up, and they're climbing on you, and you know, the practical aspect of dealing with all of that too. You know, my son wasn't at that age anymore, but by the time I got to the devices. But yeah, so unfortunately, the devices were not an option for me. So I finally had the last one removed in 2013.
Right.
That was when the last device was removed.
And your symptoms at this point were still pain and fecal incontinence?
Well, actually, it's gone a lot worse. We've fast-forwarded quite a way now, and I have got ongoing prolapses.
Yes.
So I've got a cystocele, I've got rectocele. It feels like I've got a crumpled box.
Oh,
and the walls are coming down.
Yeah.
And I'm in a mess. To make matters worse, the TVT mesh is no longer working in terms of keeping me dry from a urinary perspective. So I've got mixed incontinence now. I've got severe bladder pain. I've got urge incontinence, stress incontinence. And I'm going to appointments now and they're going, can you list your top three concerns? Because
I've got too many.
So much stuff going on. And I'm saying, well, the pain is bloody unbearable. And actually, 2016 was such a low year for me. I'd been working in cardiac rehab. You mentioned at the start, I'm a personal trainer. Now, it might sound crazy to some of the listeners, but I actually became a personal trainer back in around 2005. So I already had bladder issues and I'd had them fixed. However, I've always loved my exercise, loved my sport. And I knew I wasn't going to be your generic high jumping gym instructor. That was never going to be me. However, the people on my course were really, really good. And during my years training to become a personal trainer, they said, have you thought about a niche industry like cardiac rehab? And that's how I fell into cardiac rehab.
Right,
and I loved cardiac rehab. I loved my job. I loved helping people improve. But it got to the point where I could not stand all day. You know, I was throughout this journey, you have to bear in mind, it's not just the surgeries, it's all the hours I've spent in hospital waiting rooms. It's months and hours of my life. So trying to juggle that in around working is really hard.
It's impossible. And a lot of employers wouldn't allow for that level of time off without it compromising your position.
So my job at cardiac rehab, I sort of did 3 days, but then it slowly had to creep back to, you know, 1 day, 2 days at a time, maximum, because I wasn't coping, I wasn't managing. And then in the end, I ended up doing data entry because I couldn't stand. I was in a mess. So 2016, I'm in such chronic pain all the time. I've got bowel incontinence. I've got my bladder's a mess. I'm actually beginning to limp when I walk. And this is the biggest concern for me now because my movement is beginning to become impaired. Now, why is that? Now, it's around the time when I started looking into mesh.
Right.
And looking at what was going on with mesh. I started looking online, trying to find more information about it. I actually wanted to know what exactly I had put in me because I didn't know what this material was.
Mm-hmm.
And it became apparent there are other women who were also describing the same things I was describing. And I went to the hospital, I said, you know, is it the mesh? And they're going, it could be, but we don't know. And then there's this big fear about doing anything about mesh. Because of the unknown. So although I'd been under this same hospital for 8 years, under urogynecology, I still had an awful lot of stuff that still hadn't been addressed. And ultimately, I paid to see two consultants privately to get second opinions.
Right.
And it was those two second opinions, within 20 minutes of each appointment, both said, we can feel and we're pretty 99% sure your mesh is causing you an issue. And that was so frustrating. And I think the other thing with this is I'm not anti-male consultants. There are some fantastic ones, but it did take two female consultants in a very short period of time to acknowledge the mesh was causing me the issues.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole mesh scandal, it's so complex. It's divisive. It's heartbreaking. It's everything that shouldn't have happened for two women, especially women who were already vulnerable and were just looking for answers and help and support. And, you know, the scandal goes on, unfortunately. What happened with you? Did you have the mesh removed or?
So 16 years after I had the mesh put in, I saw these two female consultants and they're both very expert in what they do. I had confidence that either of them could do it. I just happened to go to the one that I felt had a little bit more experience.
Yeah.
I've become very wary now, as my journey has been so significant, about who I will let do what to my body now.
Yeah, of course you have.
And, you know, I knew there was no guarantees. It was quite a frightening surgery going into, because she was pretty confident she could get all the mesh out and laparoscopically, which she managed to do.
Amazing.
But despite having that surgery, and she, you know, she did actually say that it was near the obturator nerve. You know, that could explain why my left leg was doing weird things.
Absolutely.
And I've still got ongoing issues with some of the adductor muscles in there.
Yeah.
If I get tightness and other things. But essentially, the day after the surgery, I was pain-free for the first time in 16 years.
Wow. I bet you didn't recognise that feeling at all.
I woke up and I thought, it's gone.
Ugh.
The mesh is gone, but the pain is gone.
And how did you feel about that in sense of, you know, your gut feeling for a long time had been that the mesh was probably causing the pain? How did that make you feel when finally it was removed and the pain had gone?
Well, a massive sense of relief that I wasn't mad, because throughout my journey, I've been told so many times things will get better, things will go away, things will improve, but they're not, they're physical things. And when it was just sheer relief. And I think the other thing was, I'm so grateful that I actually saw that surgeon when I did.
Because
if I left it, I don't know where I'd be now, quite frankly, because things were only heading one way and they were getting worse. I remember my mum coming to visit me and she was saying, I'm really shocked. I'm really, really worried about how you're moving. She said, I've never seen you like this. You know, you're an active person, you're a fit person, and you're literally crawling along, walking.
Yeah, and I bet your identity as a really keen exerciser, plus that was your job, that must have been really, you know, taken away from you for quite some time, alongside being a mum and a wife as well. You know, the impact that must have had on your relationships with your son and your husband, that it must have impacted, surely.
It definitely has impacted. My son, I'm very grateful for the fact that he was healthy. At the end of this, you know, he was in huge signs of distress during my labour. Something could have gone really wrong with him. He's healthy.
Good.
I have a great relationship with him. You know, my motivation behind keep getting better, be the best person of my, you know, version of myself is him. You know, I love my son to bits. Oh. And I appreciate that not all women feel like this when they've had this injury. You know, some of them can have very detached relationships from their children. And I feel extremely grateful that I am not one of those women. And, you know, my son is my life. But going back to my husband, you know, my husband's incredible, but the emotional toll on him, I only came out in recent years that every time I went in for surgery, he thought I wouldn't wake up again.
Oh my goodness.
And I never knew that. And he had nobody to talk to about it.
No. And that's the thing. It's the impact.
The impact on partners.
We don't acknowledge that enough, do we?
We don't acknowledge it. And there's nobody for them to talk to. And I couldn't believe it when he told me that. I thought, you know, all these years, you've never said anything. And
Yeah. Yeah, he's the rock, and yet he's crumbling a little as well under
he's
all the
rock,
pressure right. and the fear around what's going to happen to you.
And, you know, the stress he'd been under, he'd phoned up after surgeries at time to find out how I was doing. And once they said to him, "Oh, we don't know where your wife is."
Oh, God.
And he just said, "What do you mean you don't know where my wife is?"
Wow. My goodness. Yeah, it takes a huge toll on everyone around the person that's most affected. And we definitely do forget that. And we just often offer those partners more support as well. I'm going to come on to May 6 in a moment, but I just want to get to the end of your journey, because obviously the neuromodulation didn't work, the mesh definitely didn't work. Mm-hmm. Just awful. So where are you now? Because obviously I'm fast forwarding a little bit, but you've been through more surgery. Tell us, if you would, about the surgery and what impact that's had on you, and obviously where you're at with your symptoms now.
Yeah. So once I had the mesh out, obviously I then had bladder problems again, bladder problems, because the little structural support that I had in there has gone. And I knew that. That's the point I stopped working at cardiac rehab. I ended up taking a desk job for 2 years, thought I would never teach fitness again, basically. And I accepted, that's what it was going to be like. My surgeon had a plan for me. So the idea was to have the mesh removed. Then she was going to address the prolapses that remained. So about 4 months after the mesh was out, I underwent a rectoenterocele repair with perineal body muscle reconstruction, which was probably
it's
the
extensive.
Most painful surgery I have been through. And she said to me, I hate doing this surgery. The surgery is incredibly painful. Oh. And I actually felt like I'd given birth again.
Oh, God.
However, I felt like a woman again. Anatomically, I felt so much better. I didn't have stuff from prolapses in the way all the time. So that was from the sort of gynae side.
Yeah.
We had a big debate about when we did this repair, would it make the incontinence any worse? And I was at the point where having that repair, no, it wouldn't. My incontinence is bad.
Yeah.
From a fecal perspective. So I then went to see a gastroenterologist, and she was the first one in the entire journey who suggested maybe rectal irrigation was the way forward. The neuromodulators had failed. I was originally given quite a small rectal irrigation kit, which was just like a little balloon with a pump. Mm-hmm. But I found that the water didn't stay in. It wasn't enough of a washout of what I needed to keep my rectum clear. It wasn't evacuating me consistently enough. So I then moved to a Peristeen system, which has got a balloon in it as well. So when you put the catheter into the rectum, the balloon expands, and that holds the water in. Once you mm-hmm. put the water in, then you deflate the balloon, then you let the water come out. It's quite an involved process. It takes up about an hour of every morning to do that. That worked pretty well for me. And, I could leave the house relatively confidently having done that. However, 3 to 4 years, I did it for about 4 years, but certainly during third year, I noticed that the efficacy had worn off significantly. And so I then was needing another rectal irrigation. I was having less free time now. And that's the other thing with rectal irrigation, you can't really rush it. It's not something, if you rush it, it goes wrong.
So it's a whole job. It's a job every day. It's really intensive.
And also you've got to make sure you keep your routine, your eating,
yes,
your diet, everything on track. Because if you start skewing those things, it has an effect. So it's fairly regimented. Of course, when you go on holiday, it's things like making sure you've got clean water and all that type of stuff. I was very meticulous about it. I didn't want any other infections and things.
No. It's so consuming, isn't it, all of this? It just takes over your whole life in how you manage these symptoms. Or it certainly can do.
Yeah, so rectal irrigation worked up to a point, but then it wasn't working. It was at that point where I then decided that maybe stoma would be an option for me. A stoma. Okay, so a stoma is basically a surgical opening that's created on the front of the abdomen, and it's diverting the waste. So it could either be urine or it could be feces. In my case, I had a stoma created, a colostomy, so it would divert the waste from my bowel away from the rectum, so away from the area that's the issue, into a nice little neat bag.
Yeah.
And give me back some freedom from having to, have this accidents and dealing with rectal irrigation. And now stoma had come up about maybe 8 years previous to this. So I had my stoma put in 2019. So it's coming up to 3 years.
3 years, wow.
3 years in December. I do celebrate its birthday. I have two birthdays a year now.
Oh, I love that, because I do think there's a lot of stigma around stomas and an anxiety around having one. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when we spoke recently, you actually felt maybe you wish you'd had it a bit sooner.
I do. And I think when it was mentioned 8 years ago, it was portrayed as this most horrific thing. So this was at the point when the neuromodulator stopped working. And it was just described as, you know, I really don't want to put one of those in you. It had such negative connotations that in my mind, I came out of that appointment in tears thinking, oh Christ, you know, this is the end of the world. If I have one of these things, my life is over. And so I was terrified of it. However, fast forward so much more surgery. I'm running out of options. You know, there isn't much left for me to try now. So I went to see my bowel nurse, who's my stoma nurse, and she said to me, well, you know, why don't you consider a stoma? You've tried everything else. She said, I think it could be a really, really positive thing for you. So I researched massively, as I do. I'm quite thorough with stuff now.
You're very thorough and very knowledgeable.
So, you know, I did masses of research, and I went in with an extremely positive attitude. I had about 4 to 6 weeks to prepare for my stoma surgery. And during that time, I got used to wearing a bag all the time. Now, this was partly because I knew that once you had a bag on, you can't take it off. You know, on the whole, I need something to collect the weight.
You need something there the whole time,
And it's quite alien. You know, I was never somebody to wear lots of high-waisted things before.
Yes.
It's a bit
because you're used to wearing these low cut stomach
all the time, really high waisted. Was a big change. So again, started changing my clothing. What would work when I want to exercise? You know, I had all this stuff in my mind. Tried out swimwear, different types of swimwear. What's going to give me support when I want to go back in the pool? I really researched to the nth degree. My husband was pretty positive about it all, and it was during that process when we were looking at pictures and stuff, and he actually named my stoma. So my stoma has a name, and it's called anemone.
So anemone has a name and a birthday. I mean, I love it. It's like a new person in your life, a new being in your life.
It is.
That's brought you life almost.
Yeah. And there's several reasons for doing that, really. It sort of humanizes the situation. Yeah. It's my friend. I mean, it's got a bit of a play on words, you know, anemone. She's my friend, not my enemy. There's times where she could be my enemy and I really curse her some days. But on the whole, she, you know, has changed my life. And what my stoma has done is it has given me back some control. Yeah. It's given me back time. It's given me freedom. I'm not saying a stoma is perfect. You know, my surgeon was very clear going into this. Every time I was very buoyant about it, he would say there are days where it's not going to be so good.
Yeah.
And then when I was, you know, I don't think I ever felt very negative about it, because I thought if I go down that route, then I'm not going to maybe climb out of it again. I went into it really positive. I'm also lucky that, you know, I didn't have my stoma because of an illness.
Yeah.
I haven't got any bowel disease. So in terms of recovery, in potentially my recovery was going to be good. Also, you know, I had that luxury of preparation and time to get my head around it. People who wake up with a stoma not expecting to, or it's an emergency, that's got to be such a shock. It is a massive thing. I mean, the first time I saw it, I was a bit freaked out, I'm not going to lie. The stoma nurse came and sort of unveiled it, and I was like, oh God.
This is it. But I do think what I love about your journey with your stoma is, and for anyone listening who's considering one, how active you are. You know, I mean, I think it's changed your ability to be as active as you are. You know, you're a competitive athlete as well now, particularly with your swimming. I mean, tell us about that. What's it allowed you to do with your career and with your sport?
So once I had my stoma, in fact, going into my stoma, people had contacted me who I used to train doing personal training, and they said, oh, you know, we know you've got all this stuff going on. I mean, a lot of people who I teach are very much familiar with my story anyway. They're empathetic. They get it. And so it gave me the idea that actually, yes, I could go back and do this again. You know, I don't have to give it all up. So I did. I started doing a few bits of courses and some training. I did a really good online course, actually, because although I've got a lot of knowledge on incontinence myself, there's an Association for Continence Advice. We're running an online course with FutureLearn. Ooh. And it was really, really interesting. I think part of the thing, motivation for stoma for me too, is what's going to happen to me when I'm in 70 or 80 years old. You know, most people end up in care homes because they're incontinent. I'm incontinent now and I'm mid-40s. So I'm thinking, okay, what's my life going to look at, you know, 40 years down the line? So that was another consideration. But going back to the competitive swimming, I realized, I was back in the water probably 6 weeks post-surgery.
Amazing.
I love being in water. It's the one time I actually feel normal, maybe relatively free of problems. Okay, it's not perfect. I have niggles, I have aches, it's various stuff that goes on, but it makes me feel like I can do things and be myself. So competitive swimming is something I toyed with, and then I decided to bite the bullet and try for a club, and I thought, oh, I'm not going to be good enough. So I joined the fastest swimming club. It was absolutely terrifying. I got put in the fast lane on the trial, and it was a case of like, keep swimming. I felt out of breath. I thought I was going to have a panic attack. But anyway.
You're an amazing swimmer, aren't you? I think you might be playing this down a little bit. I mean, times are fab.
The thing with the swimming is, as much as I compete and I race, one thing I cannot do, even with the freedom of my stoma, is I cannot swim to the maximal of my ability. Yes. You know, I've got to be sensible. I have scar tissue. If I push too hard, then there's a chance that I could make things worse. And so when I race, I'm racing at 70% capacity. I'd love to be able to go faster, but I can't. I can't physically because I don't want to hurt myself. So it's a quandary to be in, particularly when you're trying to do a sprint, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'm always having to rein myself back in a bit. So I am more of an endurance swimmer. I'm a longer race swimmer. But going to the competitive swimming, there's community. People were very accepting. When I go to these master swimming events, there's people in their 80s still doing this. And I look at them and I think, I'm not in a rush. I'm just sort of coming out of the end of a very long journey. I remember my son coming home when he was about 16 with a maths problem about a snail in a bucket, and this snail makes so much progress, but then it suddenly comes back down the bucket again. And it's exactly how I would describe my journey with this, because I have rehabbed myself, I've become fit, and then I've slid back down the bucket again because I've had another procedure. So 17 operations. Possibly the longest time I've had between surgeries is coming up to 3 years, and that will be maybe this December. And, you know, is this progress? Am I, as a snail, ever going to get to the rim of the bucket? Or am I going to have to keep going down this vertical surface and keep clawing my way back up again? And I do feel like I am just creeping over the bucket at the moment.
I've obviously heard about I've heard your journey a few times now, and I think this sounds a bit different. It sounds like you've turned a bit of a corner with your journey. And of course, there's always, now you're a similar age to me, the menopause, hormonal changes, and the impact that's going to have. But has it? I mean, has it had an impact on your symptoms? Are you worried about those hormonal fluctuations affecting your progress?
Yeah, I think one of the frustrations I get now definitely is my energy levels. So although I've obviously had a lot to keep processing over the years, and it's almost a form of mental exhaustion. And sometimes I don't know how much it's the total mental exhaustion of keep going and being persevering with everything I've been through, and trying to stay positive. And now I'm coming out of that, whether it's just like my whole mindset's just going, oh, I can just relax now. But certainly my sleep isn't brilliant. I don't sleep very well. I struggle with that aspect a lot. I do feel like my bladder's getting more sensitive again. I am on HRT.
Yeah.
There are days where your energy levels just aren't as good, and I recognize those now. So I adapt my training to suit that. You know, I think that's really, we put, as women, a lot of pressure on ourselves at times. And then if you add in the competitive athlete mindset on top of that, you don't want to feel like you're missing a session, or, but actually I've found now that if I am really not having a great energy day, I need to change my mindset on what I'm doing that day. You know, that's not the day to do a really hard session for me anymore. It will take too much out of me. I'm better
listening
off
to your body, isn't it? That's the thing, which we're meant to be getting better at as we get older.
I think there is, you know, there is a lot more talk about it now, about how periods affect women's ability to exercise and their symptoms and their cycles. I think there's going to be a lot more to come on that yet still.
I was going to say, sorry, Jo, I keep talking over you now. I think we're on that edge of the bucket, you know, in terms of female health. I think it's a hot topic. I think people finally, I feel like the penny's dropped a little bit. People get that we need to explore all of the topics around female health and get the research there as well. But it's a cool place to be at the moment, because finally we're addressing so much of what we should have been addressing many, many moons ago. I'm conscious of your time, so I really want to ask you two more questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
I want to just get an understanding of MASIX, because I'm a huge supporter of MASIX, and I want to, you know, make sure that everyone listening knows about them. And so would you tell us a little bit about MASIX?
Sure. So I came across MASIX in 2019. And throughout my journey, there was no support really for me as a woman living with these injuries. I didn't know of any other mothers with these type of injuries. And so when I discovered MASIX, I felt, wow, there's a charity I really feel quite strongly about, because they're making waves for women with these injuries. They're raising awareness, they're trying to change practice in terms of what happens, education for women antenatally, education of medical professionals about what the long-term consequences of OAC injury are, but more so than that, connecting other women with fellow sufferers so that they have a support network, eventually having more support groups. And they're the only UK charity that is specifically set up to deal with OAC injuries. And you can then talk to fellow people, fellow sufferers who understand what you're going through. And I think that's so important, because my journey has pretty isolated over the years at times. You know, people who don't have these symptoms might be empathetic, but they really can't fully understand it in the way that somebody else who's going through it can. And, you know, these women can share advice. On their website, there's access information to different specialist clinics around the country. You know, that they've got a good combination. They're set up by a body of medical professionals, but they've also got mothers involved on the panel too. And the two women that are the admin and the social media secretary, Anna Clements and Jen Hall, they do a fantastic job running the sort of the everyday business of MASIX. And they need a lot more support, really,
because
a lot of women are going to experience these injuries. And I appreciate we are never going to be able to eradicate third and fourth degree tears. However, I do think that women, we shouldn't hide the fact that anal incontinence is a reality if you suffer these type of tears. I think you go into any other surgical procedure and you're told to the nth degree every possibility that could go wrong, but In for some reason, when it comes to childbirth, we try and hide some of this stuff. And actually, by hiding it, we're just not prepared then.
I totally agree. And I think we talk a lot about urinary incontinence now, which is great, but I think we still need to talk more about anal incontinence. And of course, as you say, the effects that OAC tears can have on women. I'm really conscious that your story is so eye-opening. It's something no woman should have to go through, and I'm so sorry that you've had to go through what you've gone through. I feel incredibly privileged to have even met you, because you are so generous in sharing your story and inspiring other women and empowering other women. But I'm conscious that obviously if there's any pregnant women listening, I don't want to scare women either. If we could speak to you 24 years ago, what advice would you have offered yourself? What advice would you offer any pregnant woman now who's ready to give birth soon about the birthing experience and also their postnatal recovery? Is there anything you would offer, some advice you'd offer them?
Yes, so I have the three P's. So the first one would be, so promote. So for women going into this, as a pregnant woman, arm yourself with the information surrounding perineal injury, I would say. Even if you don't have access to it, look it up online. I know some stuff can be scary, but actually involve whoever's involved with your partner. Let them be aware of it too, because actually when you're in that scenario and say things like forceps or other things are being used where you might have an increased risk, you need somebody else to be helping you voice your concerns. Ask if you're unsure of anything, ask what are the risks, what are the consequences. Unfortunately, in that very emotive state and a fluid state of childbirth, things can change very rapidly. There's a big concern that everybody's going to say, I want a C-section, but actually that I don't think that is the case necessarily. And it's not necessarily the solution, but the risk stratification of an individual is so important. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was carrying a large baby. The ethnicity of my baby was never asked. My son's mixed race, so he's half black, half white. And the chance of me having a bigger baby were never even considered. First time vaginal delivery, we know, is a slightly higher risk as well. So I think that risk stratification is really important. So
no, yeah, I agree. And those birth choices, that's key as well.
I would say if you're unfortunate enough to have one of third or fourth degree tears, it's not necessarily the end of the world. If you get the correct fix at the time and the closer you can get the help that you need at the time, the better your long-term outcomes are. I would say if you're not being listened to, persevere. So this is another P. Persevere.
Yeah.
Go and see somebody else. Go and see a different GP. Keep shouting if necessary, because it's so important that you get the right help. In terms of preparation beforehand, perineal massage. You know, there's some evidence to show that perineal massage is a big help now. So learn to do perineal massage on yourself. Help prepare the perineal area. I mean, you're the expert on this one. That's where also I want to bring you in, because the importance of women's health physiotherapists when you've, both pre and post birth, I would say, if you don't know what state your pelvic floor is in before you get pregnant and then you get pregnant, maybe your pelvic floor exercises have been a bit neglected, then, you know, if you've got a very good pelvic floor going into this, then you're much better equipped coming out of it as well. And I think all women should really have an awareness of their pelvic floor. So when
you couldn't agree more.
You're going through your journey of life, whether it be having children or perimenopause, or that you know what your starting point is. So
absolutely. That proactive approach is so important, so that we don't have so much of a reactive or need for a reactive response to pelvic floor dysfunction. Jo, I can't thank you enough. I've way overgone on our time, so I do apologise. But I think your story is so strong and empowering, and I know someone listening is going to gain so much from this, if not lots of people. I live or work fairly close to you, so I certainly will and have referred into you. I love what you do, because you understand women with pelvic floor dysfunction, and it's really important for me as a pelvic health physio to work with fitness professionals who have that knowledge and expertise around pelvic health. So thank you from a personal point of view. If anyone wants to contact you or find out more about what you do, how's the best way for us to find you?
So you can email me at joeprance@outlook.com. I am on LinkedIn as well. I'm in the process of getting a website together, so please bear with me. I've just been a bit preoccupied in recent years.
Funny enough.
but yes, I would say, if you want to get in touch with me, contact me via my email is probably the best bet. And then I also have from time to time I post on Instagram as the colostomy mummy. So again, you can find me there too.
Well, that's amazing. We'll attach all of those to our show notes along with MASIC's information as well. So thank you, Jo. I'd love to get you on again at a later stage just to hear how you're getting on, and I'm sure we'll find an excuse just to tap into you later on. But thank you ever so much for joining us, and good luck with the next stage of your recovery, and keep above that bucket, or keep on top of that bucket. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I'm hanging on for dear life now at the top of the bucket.
Oh, thanks ever so much, Jo. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We really hope you enjoyed it. We always love to hear your feedback and any questions you might have. So please do contact us via Instagram at your cervix _ the podcast, or Twitter at your cervix _ PM. Don't forget to check out our wonderful sponsors, Jude and Pelvic Relief. You can find them at www.wearejude.com and www.pelvicrelief.co.uk. Gráinne and I look forward to catching up with you next week.